Hi, this is Derek Jensen with Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. And today I'm talking to Thomas Lindsay, who is the co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, as well as, and he's done just so much great stuff that I'm going to let him tell you about it instead of me telling you. He's fabulous. He's one of my heroes. And, you know, Thomas, you and I have talked a bunch of times going back to, what, 1990, 1991?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I just realized a couple of days ago that we've never actually officially talked about how you came to do the work that you do and how your thinking has evolved over the decades. And, I mean, were your first words revolution now or rights of nature or corporations aren't people? Or how did you get to where you are?
No, actually, far from it. And first off, thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here and be a part of the radio program. When I say that was probably the furthest afield that I started, that's pretty much on the mark, which is I grew up in a family of biology professors. Both my parents are teachers. And I grew up in a household where they actually raised rehabilitated animals. So when somebody was caught in a trap or a flamingo had flown off course in Alabama, where I was born and raised, that they would be called to actually raise and take care of the animal at home. And so we had what I refer to as a Grizzly Adams type of upbringing. So we had flamingos walking around the yard with broken legs. We had Galapagos tortoises in the backyard walking around. We had blue jays that had damaged wings who would flirt around the house and sit on your cereal bowl at breakfast time. And so it was a very life-affirming childhood in many ways, being exposed to that kind of nature. Yeah, it probably sounds cheesy, but, you know, I'm not sure if my parents just liked having animals around or whether they were intent on being environmental activists or those types of things. My mother was a founder of the Alabama Audubon Society, and I can remember when I was really young of them taking a congressman on a canoe trip down the Catawba River to try to protect it from dams and other threats to the Catawba in Alabama. But needless to say, I grew up in essentially a non-political household in many ways, and wanted to find a career that would put me in a place where I was working with animals. And so I became a marine biology major in college, and decided that it would take probably too long, many years of study and to get the ability to do field work. But to cut a long story short, eventually decided to go into law and do pre-law and then go to law school. And I guess my radicalization started to take place in law school, which is where people started coming to us as third-year law students, asking us for help in stopping things like toxic waste incinerators and landfills and sewage sludge dumping and hog factory farms and those types of things coming into their communities. And as law students, we had to tell them that the option to say no to certain things coming into the communities was not theirs. In other words, that they had very little control over what happened within their own communities, and that control was actually exercised by state agencies who were issuing permits for the corporations to put those things in, by the corporations who were writing the very regulations under which ostensibly they were supposed to be regulated by the state agencies. And for a while, we thought that the problem was really that there just wasn't enough lawyers out there, because even today there's only 200 full-time public interest environmental lawyers who practice in the United States. And the fact is, we thought that the job was to add more lawyers to that list, and so that's what we did. And we created the Legal Defense Fund to provide free legal services to these community organizations so they would have lawyers that could appeal permits and do the type of regulatory law that environmental lawyers are known for. And even at that time, you know, that's not very radical in many ways, which is to create a law firm to provide free legal services to do permit appeals. That's not a really radical thing to do. And I think the place where we switched gears to becoming more radical was as we watched this permit system play out. You know, you'd have a governmental agency issue a permit to the Waste Management Corporation to put in a toxic waste landfill, and the community group would come to us and ask us to represent them in appealing the permit. And we would do so, and most of the times we would win, because the challenge for environmental lawyers is generally to find gaps, omissions, and deficiencies within the permit application that the corporation has put in and argue that the permit shouldn't have been issued in the first place, that the state made a mistake of some kind. And even though we'd win, you know, round after round after round of those, because we would keep picking the application apart, eventually at some point the corporation would come back with a new and improved permit application that had everything in it that was needed, and then the permit would issue. And the community group would come back to us and they'd say, Mr. Lindsay, we need you to do that jujitsu that you did the first time around to actually stop this toxic waste incinerator from coming into the community. And we would be forced to turn back to them to say, well, we're sorry, there's nothing we can do for you anymore because the corporation has now perfected their permit. And I think it was at that point in time that something snapped in us that, you know, prior to that, we were obedient to this structure of law that continues to allow, even when it's working perfectly, it regulates the destruction of how quickly the nature and ecosystems are destroyed. So even when operating perfectly, the regulatory system is all about just orderly regulating that process, the orderly rate of destruction, in other words. And I think we came to that conclusion when we, you know, got the awards and the funding and everything else for being good environmental lawyers. But at the same time, if you actually set foot in the communities where we had been doing work, you saw absolutely no relationship between that community and the win that we had gotten in court, because in essence we weren't stopping anything from going in anywhere. And
so you just slowed it down for a couple of years.
Yeah, for many years. For 8 years, we did conventional environmental law practice, and then we came to this realization, and it was really punctuated by these large hog factory farms moving into south central Pennsylvania, and farmers turning to us saying, we don't want these things because they're not sustainable, and us saying, well, you can't say no to them because that's how the law is set up. To which they said, we don't care how the law is set up. We don't want these things here, and we want you to help us, in essence, collectively break the law to challenge some of these doctrines that are out there that keep us from actually being able to decide what happens in our own community. And that set off a slew of work that we had never seen before, that we didn't get into the business of doing, but that we do today, which is essentially saying to folks, hey, you don't have a fracking problem, you don't have a factory farm problem, you don't have a sludge problem, you have a democracy problem. Because, in essence, there are these legal doctrines that have been manufactured over the past 200 years to actually give corporations more rights and powers than you have in your own community where the corporation is attempting to do business. And so I think, for me at least, going back to the question, it was a long, slow train, which I think it is for many people. For us, we had to be pushed and prodded and argue that we were the lawyers, not the organizers, and somebody else needed to figure it out. And the communities themselves actually had to push us through a very painful process of coming to an understanding that we don't have democracy in this country because we don't even govern what happens in our own communities, and that what we have in many ways is a corporate state in which the corporations have, and the very few number of people who control the major corporations, have much more rights, power, and authority than the people themselves within those communities.
Let's talk explicitly about, for a moment, how the people don't have the right to control whether, through the Constitution, the right to control whether a factory hard farm goes into their community or whether their community allows fracking. So what happens is, at first you would try to stop the permits, but then you realize that the process of permitting is just the process of permitting, really.
Yes.
And then you would start doing helping communities put in, for example, a ban against corporate hog farms or fracking, But then that runs into a commerce clause in the Constitution. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, which is they're not called permits for nothing. They're actually the state legalizing a certain activity. So, you know, the Toxic Waste Incinerator Corporation can't put in the toxic waste incinerator unless its activities are legalized through that state permitting authority. And so when communities rise up and they say, we don't want that here, the typical response from environmental lawyers is, well, you have to accept it. You can fight to regulate it better, which, in essence, you're just enforcing the corporation's own regulations against them, because generally that's who's written the regulations that are in law in the first place. So you can do that, but you're going to get drilled or factory farmed or incinerated or whatever you're trying to stop. It just may be a little bit less painful. And you may carve off some of the rough edges through the regulatory process. But if you want to outright say no, you know, no big box stores. We don't want any Walmarts here because we know that they damage the downtown, the health of the downtown that we have here and the downtown businesses and everything else, that if you want to frontally say no to the Walmart coming in, you can't. And the reason why you can't under traditional conventional law is this combination of these four legal doctrines that are in place. And you mentioned one of them, which is corporate commerce clause rights. The Constitution has created a right to commerce, specifically a right to interstate commerce, but almost everything has been defined as interstate commerce. And so there's a right for corporations to engage in commerce. And the reason why that's dangerous is that it's privately enforceable. So there's the commerce clause in the U.S. Constitution that sits there. But if a community tries to say, I don't know, stop coal from being shipped across their borders, like the people in the city of Bellingham attempted to do last year, they're targeted for these coal train shipments, which are coming from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, being shipped across the city of Bellingham, Washington, and then being offloaded to China and Asia for coal exports. That if your community says, wait a minute, we shouldn't be extracting and burning fossil fuels because of the climate implications, and plus we don't like the fact that the coal is going to have coal dust and all those other things, that we want to say no to coal being shipped across our borders. What you run into first is the Commerce Clause, which is the right of the BNSF Corporation, which is the railroad corporation, to actually engage in the commerce of shipping coal across the city. And so in that case, it's very clear the corporation's Commerce Clause rights outweigh the rights of the community to say no to that shipment going through. And that's just one doctrine, the Commerce Clause stuff. There's three others. The second one is the corporate personhood stuff, which gets very complex, but corporations have personhood rights in the U.S., and one of those rights is the right not to have property taken without compensation from a governmental entity. So let's say a government passes a law banning factory farms. If the corporation has a legal right to put the factory farm in, i.e. it has a state permit to do so, then what you're doing at the local level by banning it is actually taking the property of the corporation that wants to put the factory farm in, and therefore you owe the factory farm the cost of losing that permit that the corporation has obtained. So you got the Commerce Clause, you got personhood rights, and then you got the two other doctrines which people are more familiar with, I think. One is preemption, which basically says whatever the state passes, that the state can limit what you can do at the municipal level. So if the state passes an oil and gas act that says, okay, now we're going to license fracking within the state, they can preempt a municipality from doing anything more stringent than what the state has put into place. So if a municipality wants to ban something, it can't because the state has now licensed the activity. And then the flip side of that is something called Dillon's Rule, which is that unless the state gives explicit authorization to a municipality to pass a certain kind of law, the municipality does not have the ability to pass that law. So if a municipal corporation, one of our towns, says, we're going to ban fracking here, one of the challenges that comes in the door is the corporation saying, you don't have the power to pass that here because the state hasn't given you the authority to do it. And those four legal doctrines combine to put us in a box. We call it the box of allowable activism. We're allowed to play in that box as long as we don't interfere with those legal doctrines, which actually define the sides of the box. And it's there that we ask the question, do we think we can have economic and environmental sustainability, whatever that means, by continuing to stay within the box? And the answer increasingly has been no, which has meant communities saying, well, okay, we know those doctrines are there. We've now begun to redefine the problem as not being about fracking, but actually about the fact that those doctrines have divested us of any democratic governing authority within our own community. And now they're starting to fight back over that.
So let's be really explicit. What those doctrines suggest is that a local community cannot effectively determine their environmental or economic or social future if they choose to, but basically that's all. They can't determine their ecological, economic, or social future. There can be no meaningful local autonomy. Because if Walmart wants to move into your community, those doctrines would suggest that you effectively can't stop them.
That's right. And not just effectively suggest, but have stopped similar efforts over the last 100 years or so. And so the question, getting at yours more in depth, which is if you want a healthy downtown and you can't say no to Walmart coming in, then you can't have a healthy downtown. In other words, it's not just about the anti. It's not just about stopping things. It's if your vision is of a sustainable community, yet you can't say no to the unsustainable uses of that community that are being made by other entities coming in from outside your community. You can't envision or build a sustainable community for yourself. And on the flip side of that is, on the climate change arena, for example, if communities actually can't stop the emissions and can't stop the combustion that's occurring, that's creating and worsening climate change, then we're always reliant on federal and state levels of government, which, as we know, aren't going to do a thing to actually take serious steps to stop global warming and climate change. And so if we accept the fact that in our own communities we can't actually govern towards sustainability because of these legal doctrines, and we, throw in the towel and go home and say, well, there's nothing we can do. It's traditional law. It's been law for a long time. Our lawyers tell us we can't challenge it. Our elected officials say that it's well-settled law and can't be tweaked or can't be changed or can't be overturned. Then we might as well just throw in the towel on everything, because unless we're willing to actually challenge the fundamental doctrines, which have been carefully laid into place to keep us caught within that box of allowable activism, we're screwed, because it makes us reliant on higher levels of government, and those higher levels of government are going to be the last ones to move, and they're probably only going to move as things completely fall apart, as opposed to partially falling apart now, and so it's going to be too late. And so we either have to reclaim or claim for the first time our governing authority to actually move in the direction of sustainability, or we need to go home, turn on the TV, and be content as the whole place starts to cave in, which is what's happening now.
So how are communities fighting back against us?
Well, it started out with those communities in South Central Pennsylvania who are fighting factory farms, and those farmers and others in those rural communities who said, we don't want them. And so we drafted some local laws for them that actually banned corporate farming. So it banned corporations from actually establishing the factory farm. So they were corporate ordinances that focused on the imbalance between corporate power and the power of the people living in the community, rather than on the individual single harm, which is the factory farm stuff. That work that we did on factory farms then began to spread, and it has spread out to different issues, including corporate water withdrawals, corporate sewage sludge being applied to land. Fracking has become a big issue for us as well. Public-private transportation corridors in Maine is now cropping up as a big issue. These private investors putting private roadways in across some of Maine's rural communities. Energy issues, stopping the Northern Pass project, which is this huge power line project to wheel power down from Canada to the East Coast. There are some New Hampshire communities that are now standing up against those as well. And they're all doing it as part of what we refer to as rights-based organizing. So they're about adopting a local bill of rights that actually recognizes people's rights to sustainable energy, people's rights to clean air and clean water, people's rights to self-government. It's essentially a rights movement. And these ordinances are fascinating. They've evolved quite a bit over the last 10 years that we've been working on them. But they're essentially local constitutions. And what we think we see happening in the 150 or so communities in eight states that have now adopted these, either through their local governments or through citizen initiative lawmaking power, is that we're seeing a new movement towards actually changing the law so that it supports sustainability rather than the law as it currently sits, which is, and I said this, which is controversial before, but sustainability is illegal under our system of law. It's actually against the law because you can't move in the direction of sustainability if it affects certain corporate rights and powers. And so the question is, how do we give birth to a structure of law that, instead of punishing communities for moving towards sustainability, actually supports, validates, and in many ways propels forward communities based on this local self-government concept to actually begin passing laws that ban power lines, that actually ban oil and gas drilling, which the county of Mora in New Mexico just last month became the first county in the United States to ban all oil and gas drilling within their borders. The city of Pittsburgh, which banned fracking within its municipality. How do we actually give birth to a movement of these communities across the United States who will become powerful enough to not only put their own laws in place, but also begin to erode away those state and federal levels of legal structures, those doctrines that we talked about, to actually nullify them, to get rid of them, and actually replace them with something that actually puts the rights of people and nature above the rights of corporations and property and commerce.
Wait, so I mean, everything you're saying sounds great, but what happens? Okay, so some community puts in place this this local constitution, this new structure, but what happens when that comes in conflict with the state and fed and corporate triangle? If, you know, my community can, well, I shouldn't talk about my community because it's really right wing here, so they would, if anything, pass a rights of Walmart type ordinance. But leaving that aside, you know, Pittsburgh bans fracking. What happens if the state of Pennsylvania says, that's very nice, my little Pittsburgh, but you don't actually get to do that because it's unconstitutional? I mean, isn't that the big stick that they pull out?
Well, it already has. They've been pulling it out for about 7 years now in Pennsylvania to counter what we've been doing at the community level. But the short answer to that is it's exactly what you want. In other words, you win two ways if you design these campaigns in a way that go after the doctrines rather than just after the single issue. The first one is that they leave you alone. The city of Pittsburgh passed the ban on fracking, became the first major city in the United States to do so. The oil and gas industry threatened to sue them in November of 2010. In fact, threatened to sue them the day after it was passed. They didn't. It's actually still law within the city of Pittsburgh. It's lasted now over two and a half years, a little bit longer. And one of the issues is that the corporations sometimes don't want to tangle with these laws because they understand that they're about rights. They're not about parts per million or how much, you know, liquid manure can be applied per acre of land. They're actually about community rights versus corporate rights. And they don't necessarily want to get into that fight unless they absolutely have to, which is why they've left Pittsburgh alone. They've also not sued the dozen other communities that followed Pittsburgh's lead. And in fact, in Mora County, this is the first county in the U.S. to pass the oil and gas ban in the, at the county level, we're now a month and a half, 2 months and counting after that's been passed, and still nothing's been filed. So the ideal way to win, of course, is to say, hey, we're putting a flag in the ground here. This is what we want for the community, and we're actually going to impose that view, and we're going to chase you away as the corporation wants to put it in. knowing that resource extraction and other types of industries similar to that in the U.S. have always been bolstered and encouraged, and in fact, those industries have always struck back when communities have done anything to control the rate of extraction or whether it happens at all, is that we expect lawsuits to be filed. There's going to be 10, by the time we're done, probably 10,000 lawsuits will be filed. And the key to the lawsuit is that when the corporation sues over these ordinances, what they have to validate are all of the legal doctrines that the ordinance seeks to nullify. So they have to walk into court and actually validate that corporations are persons. They actually have to validate that corporations have commerce rights within the community that overthrow or overpower the community rights. They have to go through each of the doctrines and actually validate them in court. The question is, why is that valuable? Well, it's valuable because most people in the United States think that we live in a democracy. You know, you walk into a room and you say, well, we don't live in a democracy. Most people still think you're crazy in most circles. And so the concept here is, can we put an organizing strategy together that if the ordinance is untouched, great, that's a win. But assuming that the ordinance is going to be sued over, assuming that it's going to be pulled into the courts, how do we use it as a vehicle to actually begin to radicalize those large numbers of people who actually are obedient to the existing system because they think it works? And that's the majority of people. So how do we actually rip that veil away by using the actual campaign, the actual issue that people care about, the actual doctrines that the corporations are going to come in to actually use to try to overthrow the ordinance? How do we reveal in all of its nastiness, in all of its, you know, complete insanity, how the system actually functions? Because the system's actual functioning is camouflaged so carefully to not allow very many people to see it. It's why most people believe that we operate in a democracy, and that when the judges make decisions, they're neutral and everything else. The idea here is to make it play out in front of people, actually force their eyes open to see how it functions, and then find other mechanisms, even if that ordinance is overturned, to continue to radicalize that population towards a legislative overturning, a constitutional overturning of those court decisions. And so in some states where we work, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Washington, Ohio, folks in different communities understanding that they have to change the state law before they're going to have a shot at winning, for the most part, in local courts, have actually formed community rights networks. And those CRNs are now moving forward with state constitutional changes and state legislative changes that, in essence, will legalize the ordinances that they're passing at the local level. So, you know, the long and short of it is to say, when people walk in the door and say, hey, we want to stop fracking within our community, the flippant answer we have is, okay, well, that means changing the Constitution. If you want to stop fracking in your community, it means actually changing the structure of law that guarantees that the corporation can come in and frack within your community. It's about leveraging people's individual community activism into something collective that actually begins to drive what I don't think has been seen in this country for the last 100 years, which is a real people's movement aimed at driving sustainability into those constitutional structures. And so, you know, those losses that people would see as losses within the courts actually become wins because they begin to leverage that larger people's movement to emerge by forcing people to understand how the system actually functions and how it actually works.
I have to tell you, that all makes me really happy.
Well, it makes me happy until the mornings I wake up and think about how much work it's going to take.
Yeah, I hear you. Most people, a lot of people understand that corporations have rights as people, legal rights as people, which seems completely nuts to me. And one of the things you're talking about is how communities and nature under this legal system don't have rights. And so I'm wondering, you know, that's one of the things that you've been really moving toward the last many years is promoting rights of nature. And so I'm wondering if there's two things we can talk about with this. The first one is, you have famously said that there really has not been an environmental movement. And because of the issue of rights. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about that and then segue from that into discussing your work around the rights of nature.
Sure. The conclusion I came to was that, and others have as well, there's other law professors. I mean, none of this is new. Indigenous communities have had a different view of nature for the past 10,000 years. So when we talk about nature not having rights, you know, it's nothing that white people invented. It's something ancient. All we've done is take the concept, begin talking about it as relevant to the way that our systems of law, our English systems of law, actually function, and how to change those systems of law and how they function to recognize that nature is not property, but means nature having rights of its own. And so, you know, when I started making statements that we've never had an environmental movement in the United States, it stems from the understanding about how movements have been built in the past in the United States. So, you know, you had the abolitionist movement, which worked for, you know, some people would say 80 to 100 years, beginning in the early Quaker days, towards abolishing slavery. In essence, the movement sought to take slaves, African Americans, that were treated as property, i.e. owned by someone else, and building a movement that then converted that slave, that African-American, from being property to being a rights-bearing entity. So again, changing the structure of law so it didn't recognize African-Americans as property, slaves as property, but instead transform the structure of law so that the structure of law recognized the slave as a rights-bearing entity, no longer a slave, but as a person. So from property, from being from property to a person, which means all the difference in the world because, you know, in the 1840s, it was impossible to commit homicide. It was impossible to murder a slave because a slave was property. It was owned by someone else. And so it was not a criminal offense. It was actually a crime against property, which meant that you then paid the slave owner damages from not being able to use the slave. That's the difference between being property and being a person. The women's rights movement, the suffragists, did the same. They sought to take women from status as property to being a person. It wasn't in the 1820s, it wasn't possible to rape a woman as a criminal offense. It was a property crime. You paid the husband damages from his lack of being able to use his property. So how the law views entities, individuals, either as property or as persons, is the entire ballgame. And for the last, you know, 1,000 years of quote-unquote civilized law in the industrialized world, nature has been property, nature is owned, which means that the more money you have, the more of nature you can buy. And when you buy nature and ecosystems, the law carries with it the ability and authority for you to destroy the ecosystems that you've purchased. So if nature is property, the more nature you own, the more nature you can destroy. That's been the system of law under which we've operated in the United States, and it's a holdover from English common law and further back into the industrialized and colonial expansion of law that occurred. And so in the United States, we've had environmental groups that have attempted to build an environmental movement based on the concept that nature is property. So in essence, what they've been urging is a more careful use of that property. In other words, environmental regulation to try to keep nature from being harmed while not taking on the core concept that nature is actually property or owned under this system of law. The reason why there's never been an environmental movement in this country is because nature is property. And real movements take property and convert property into being rights-bearing entities. We've never had a movement that's actually focused on that. Or if we've had, it's been called radical and crazy and, you know, you can't give rocks rights and all that kind of stuff. Well, starting in 2005, several communities that we've been working with actually began adopting laws that we drafted, which established within those communities that nature ecosystems are not property, but that ecosystems have a right to exist and flourish independently, and that their rights can be enforced by the people within the community who have an interest in seeing those ecosystems protected. And so today we have about 36 communities across the United States that have passed those types of laws. at some point, those laws got the attention of folks in Ecuador, where a constitutional commission, their constitutional convention was meeting to actually draft a new constitution for the country of Ecuador. A group that we work with called the Pachamama Alliance, which has close ties with some Ecuadorian officials, actually got us an invite to come down to work with the constitutional convention to take the language from these municipalities in the U.S. and actually help them draft something that could be inserted into the Ecuadorian constitutional rights provisions. And that occurred back in 2008. It made it into the final draft. The final draft was then voted on by the public, and it passed overwhelmingly. Since which, not to short-circuit this, but Ecuador at that point became the first country in the world to actually recognize a rights-based system of environmental protection. And since then, we've had three court cases come down in which judges have actually ruled on behalf of the ecosystems that brought the case. So under this new system that's being developed, ecosystems can be plaintiffs. So, you know, it's like back in slave days, the plaintiff would be the slave owner. Well, in environmental cases today, generally it's a person who is the plaintiff, alleging that his use of nature or ecosystems has been infringed by something. That's the locus or the purpose of the suit. In these cases, you actually have the Vilcabamba River in Ecuador as the plaintiff bringing suit. So people stepping into the shoes of the ecosystem to then examine the damage to the rights of the ecosystems directly rather than damage to individuals as derivative of the damage that was done to the ecosystem. And so it's all about putting ecosystems and nature on a rights footing and then building a system of law that recognizes and enforces their rights. Ecuador right now is the leader. We're looking at a high-profile enforcement case in the United States on rights of nature. That probably won't happen until next year sometime. But it's all about forcing the legal system to change and doing it from the ground level up by communities saying, well, we're going to recognize that ecosystems in nature have rights of their own rather than just rights through our use of it.
Once again, that all makes me really happy. I want to go a slightly different direction for a second and ask about what you think of there's a barrister in UK, Polly Higgins, and she's attempted to make ecocide an international crime on a par with genocide. And what do you think about, well, there's that, plus there's also, I'm sure you heard recently that China has made a certain amount of polluting a crime punishable by death. And I'm wondering about what you think about those approaches.
We're familiar with Polly's work. There's a lot of people that are working really high up in the clouds, you know, 30,000 feet up at the UN level or at the international level. We're of the conclusion that the system has been so tightly wound over these past 1,000 years or so that just trying to convince higher level officials, whether that's the United Nations or somebody else, to do something is probably impossible. And that the only thing that's going to actually force this kind of structural paradigm-changing stuff is a revolt or an insurrection from below. And that's the only way that law changes. And so we've watched a lot of these high-profile efforts come and go. There's usually almost no residue left from them. And so while I would applaud ecocide as a crime, it's not going to happen anytime soon except at the local level. And so we hope that people put more energy into the local stuff because without that building up, there's no way to force those higher levels to do anything. The China model is the same. I mean, it's not about ecosystems having rights. It's about more penalties for pollution or for, you know, in other places, wetlands destruction. But it's not a shift towards a rights basis. It's actually something different. It's just about making the regulations tougher, which is a good idea, but it's not a nature's rights position. And as part of the rights of nature work that we've done, there's now a global alliance for the rights of nature that's been formed. We sit on the board of it.
Okay, so say someone in the United States or elsewhere, but let's, I guess, make it easy in the United States, loves this idea of rights of nature and wants to, on either the community level or even on the personal level, with their own land, would like to somehow attempt to codify this, what would you suggest they do?
Well, they can work with us to put an ordinance together. We have experience now in about 25 states about doing local lawmaking directly, but also through citizens initiative. And from a personal angle, if you're in a place where the local government is not a local government that's amicable to this type of thing, and you may not have an option to make law yourself, i.e. through citizen initiative or home rule powers or whatever might be available to you, we developed an easement system last year that actually takes property that you might have and allows you to put the rights of nature legal system into place in a way that governs your own property. So even though it falls short of getting actual law codified, it actually puts a new system of law in place on your property. It's almost a new twist to the way conservation easements have been used in the past. But it's a way of putting the rights of nature structure into place on property that you might own as a restriction on your deed, so as a deed easement. So that's something we help people do as well.
So I want to put this back. We only have just a few minutes left. And one thing, and you reference this, but I want to put this explicitly in the context of historical revolutionary or anti-colonial movements, that one of the things that, you know, for all the problems with all the patriots and, you know, the anti-British pro, you know, George Washington and co, one of the things they did pre-Revolutionary War that was really smart is they set up their own system of courts that was parallel to the colonial system to, and part of the reason was to delegitimize the crown system. And likewise, the Irish, that was part of the Irish resistance movement, was to set up their own systems of community self-governance to, as part of the process of decolonizing. And so it seems to me, and I just want to know if you put yourself in the same sort of recognizing there are problems with both those traditions, but if that's explicitly what you're doing, it seems like it's part of what you're doing, attempting to delegitimize the current system, which is colonial internally as well as externally, and to, I mean, there's a long and wonderful tradition of this historically.
Yeah, and I think that line melds well with the other line, which is nonviolent civil disobedience, which is sometimes the tag people put on this work, is that it's collective nonviolent civil disobedience through municipal lawmaking. So it's actually, you know, instead of one or two people sitting down at a lunch counter, it's whole communities sitting down at a lunch counter daring the power structure to actually come down on them, because when it does, other people can see them being beaten by it and hopefully change. And so I think there's two strands here. Number one is sitting down saying, we're not going to do this anymore. And the second one is finding a critical mass of people who have given up hope, just like the Irish gave up hope in the colonial structure of government, just like the American revolutionaries gave up hope that there was going to be any change to the British structure. Enough people have to give up hope in the state and federal levels of government that we have that they're actually going to deliver some kind of meaningful change, because it's only when people give up hope on that end that they actually begin doing whatever they need to do themselves to build that new structure of law. And so building that new bridge is very important as the old one collapses, because as traffic starts to move across the new bridge, it automatically validates that new bridge structure as well as delegitimizing the old bridge.
That's all great. Is there anything else you want to say to listeners today?
I think that's it. There's a lot of work ahead, but I think a new form of activism that moves forward is in many ways the only hope that we have left.
Well, thank you so much, Thomas, and thank you, listeners. And this has been Thomas Lindsay on Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.